Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast with your host, Andrew Keel. This is the podcast where you can get the education you need to invest 100% passively in the highly profitable niche of mobile home parks.
Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Keel, and today I'm thrilled to have a new guest on the show, Mr. Dustin Wiskus. All right, before we jump in, I want to ask a quick favor. If you're enjoying this podcast, could you please take just a quick second and rate it or review it on your favorite platform, wherever you listen to your podcast? It means the world to me and helps us reach more listeners. So thanks for doing that favor for me. All right, let's dive in. Today's guest, Dustin Wiskus, has an inspiring journey in the mobile home park space. Dustin works full-time as an engineer and began investing in mobile home parks back in 2021. His first deal was a 28-space value-add community in western Wisconsin. Since then, he's grown his portfolio to 9 mobile home communities with approximately 275 lots, all within the home state of Wisconsin. Dustin, welcome to the show.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Andrew. Big fan, as I mentioned there, and a longtime listener. So look forward to chatting with you here.
Awesome, man. I mean, you being a Wisconsin fan, you know, we talked a little bit. You know, I got my Travis Kelce jersey on today. This is not a Green Bay Packers jersey. So it's playoff time.
I know. It has arrived. So all the hype is starting here. I mean, the Chiefs just have such a team. It's going to be hard to compete. But anyway, we always are hopeful here in Green Bay. You know what I mean?
We got a pretty good chance. Yeah, you got a chance. You got to be in it. So that's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, Dustin, would you mind just starting out by sharing a little bit about your story and how in the world you got into investing in mobile home parks?
Yes. As you mentioned, I started in 2021 with mobile home parks. But just prior to that, you know, I was actually pretty confident I was going to just be buying like duplexes around the Green Bay area here. My good friend of mine kind of got me involved in that, helped me get started. And I thought that was actually going to be the clear path to, you know, financial freedom and everything everyone hopes for in that regard. My wife and I did, you know, kind of go down that path for a few years. And then, you know, just like anything else, it wasn't scaling quick enough and wanted something, you know, we could maybe manage remotely someday because, again, just we always would. If you invest in something, you know, 5 minutes down the road, you're always going to be inclined to, like, you know, mm-hmm. be the guy to go fix the issue or what have you. And I was doing that nonstop. So needed to kind of pivot. And I don't really know. I think maybe it was like Bigger Pockets or something like this back in that time, where maybe Brandon Turner or it was somebody in that space that was talking about mobile home parks. I'm like, you know, I was just like following what, you know, smart people are doing there. You know, if they think there's something there, I might as well, you know, pursue it. So yeah, I took Frank and Dave's boot camp 2020 timeframe. I actually had to go look that up to see, like, back in my old email archives there when that actually was. So it was like mid 2020. Like, okay, this is
COVID. That's the COVID year.
COVID.
So I think was it in person or virtual?
It was like maybe one of the first virtual experiences, which was fine because I wasn't like trying to go jump on a plane if this thing wasn't going to be for me. So like, sure. Yeah, it worked out. So we just sat and did that whole course. And I was like, okay, we got to just start, you know, deal finding at that point. And I think, I mean, it was at least 6 months, I think, until anything even remotely interesting came about. And LoopNet, of all places, which is usually where deals go to die, you know?
Yeah. LoopNet's where you found your first one?
Yeah. And it was just a random listing. You know, a broker just put a listing out there. There wasn't some big offering package. It was like a single page handwritten in the offering documents there with like number of spaces, you know, number of occupied. Didn't even mention how many tenant-owned homes and or anything like to that regard. So anyway, I think I just remember sitting, I was like putting my 2-year-old to sleep and I was like, oh my God, I got to like call this lady right now. It was one of those random finds. And I must've got her before, you know, the rush of other people tried to get a hold of her. And I got, you know, her to send in an offer, you know, basically for me there. And that's how we ended up getting that one. But that had a lot of hair on that deal in hindsight. I was willing to look past anything to get the first deal, but it was like, it was one of those classic ones where it was like master metered electric. Yeah. The previous owners would, they were telling me when I met them, they were like going around with, you know, a notepad and paper, getting electric meter readings every month and billing it back. And I'm like, this is wacky. Jeez. Are you sure this is like the case here? Normal. And they're like, oh, yeah,
is this normal?
Yeah. And actually, I was almost going to kill that deal because I was like a little nervous at the time. I'm like, everybody tells me not to buy something like this. I just took the boot camp. They said, you got to be really wary of this. But we did it. And it worked out that I negotiated like a credit. And then within a few months, I had all new, you know, we got that converted. It actually wasn't that big of a process. And I got money at closing to basically help remedy,
nice,
get that all taken care of there. But it was your classic value add. What's that?
Do you have to install a pedestal at every lot? Around like $1,500 a lot, maybe more.
That's about right. Yeah. High five.
And then tread, like, then you have to, like, you know, get the main line over there.
Yep. So they went
from the transformer.
You're correct. Yep. They had to. There was a study done. Luckily, I don't know if this is the case everywhere, but it was somewhat of a more of a local utility provider, not one of the big national brands that's all over the place. So they were fairly easy to work with. Okay. And they, don't quote me on this, but I think they were offering basically to help me out because it was aging. So I was able to kind of like get on the phone with some of the guys in charge of how much the fees were going to be for them to put in their new main and then trench in all the, you know, all the laterals and maybe add a transformer. But yeah, it, you know, it was a hefty price, but I tried to estimate that ahead of time there and get some credit at closing. It wasn't completely, I still had to come out of pocket some, but I was like, oh, this is worth it. brand new electric for.
Was it septic and well also?
Nope. That was city, all city utilities there.
Nice.
Formerly septic and well, but prior to me purchasing it, they had converted at some point in time. Man, I think they negotiated because there's a water tower actually like almost in the park for the city. So like when the city put that up, they needed a easement through the park to get to the new water tower. The park had to give up a lot. That's what it was. The park had to give up a lot, but then the city actually put in like a new main in the park. As a part of that, I was like, oh my God.
That's a pretty good trade-off.
I'm trying to get that everywhere. Yeah. Yeah.
That's awesome. So that was the first park, 28 lots, and you took the boot camp beforehand. So you had the due diligence handbook. I mean, what type of mistakes did you make on that first deal that, you know, moving forward, you've kind of learned from?
Yeah, I guess I would just say I didn't go through the due diligence handbook probably as well as I should have. I mean, I tried to do the main ones. I got like a, you know, I got an environmental study done. In hindsight, I probably should have got more of a proper survey done to kind of see some of the boundaries, because I think that those got actually a little tight.
When I first got started, I was cheap and I didn't have a lot of money. So I was doing the boundary surveys at the beginning.
Yeah.
And, you know, I learned a few years ago that like the Alta surveys are worth their weight in gold because, you know, they point out all the underground utility lines, not only the, you know, the boundary issues and the tidal issues, but the underground utility lines is just a huge benefit in my opinion. Like we had gas lines that were going under some homes and we didn't even know about it until we got to the refinance point. And then the agency lender required the Alta survey. But I just think the Alta is worth it. But I know on some smaller properties, it's like, hey, this is never going to be like an agency quality park or an agency loan type of deal. Why pay the extra money? But yeah, something to think about.
That's the reality. And that's actually for the most part, my whole portfolio there, they're all smaller deals. I mean, what's the average? I don't know, anywhere from smallest deal, you know, smallest park is like 12 up to biggest ones like 54. And there's everything in between.
Nice.
So only a couple of those might actually qualify. I don't even know what those qualifications probably are.
But I bet, Dustin, if you packaged them all together and cross-collateralized them as a Wisconsin portfolio loan, I bet you an agency lender would look at it.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So
gotcha.
That would be worth it. Do you have any investors on these deals? Do you raise money from friends or is it all you?
No. We've basically just done everything ourselves. I say ourselves, my wife and I. We don't have any investors or anything like that. So it's all just been one at a time And actually, previous to this, it was like, you know, improving those like duplexes at the time and then pulling equity out of those and rolling that into that first mobile home park. And then we did kind of the value add model of infill, build back, water, sewer, all that jazz. So it, you know, improves the NOI, and then we refinance that one to go get the next. And that's just been this, it's been like a snowball effect to date.
That's huge. And it's, yeah. and it's only been what, 3 years, and it's already, yeah, yeah, you're hitting that snowball effect. So you must be doing some serious value add deals. Like, tell us about that, you know, like the infill and kind of what that looks like. And then what your plan is, do you go back to the same local bank to yeah, recollateralize it after you've added the value?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's like the, everything you read about or hear about is like the build back water and sewer is like day one. If I ever buy a park that's not submetered, I'm picking up the phone, sending an email to Metron. That's just who we use to go get a bunch of meters to put on all of them. Almost every deal we buy is like under market rents.
Let's go back to the Metron thing real quick. Do you guys get the master meter as well?
I never have. I've always thought about it.
The reason why we do that is that we can track the usage, because we've had the cities where the city, you know, main meter will be off and it'll be reading bad. And then they're charging us all this and we're like, well, we can't find this leak. And we've looked everywhere. We've hired American Leak Detection and everything. We couldn't find this leak. And come to find out, it was the city's meter that was reading wrong. So luckily the master meter, you know, I think for an extra $2,000,
right,
you can tell the difference between the submeters and the master meter to know if the water is actually even going through.
That's exactly what my head was at too. Because I just got an email from one of the municipalities that she's just like, hey, do you know, you know, because to your point, it's sometimes every quarter where they send you the meter reading. So you could have 3 months of a catastrophic leak somewhere if it's not showing itself in the park and you would never know. So she just emailed me like a few weeks ago. She's like, hey, do you know you use like 600,000 gallons? And I was like, what? You gotta be kidding me. I'm like doing the math in my head. I'm like, oh, that's not, you know, that's a hefty bill. They read the meter wrong. That was it. That was like
an extra all there zero was to. Has huge effects.
I just, you know, it's one of those things where you know, and that wasn't the first time. And I actually had an excavator. I had American Leak Detection on standby, like about to, it was like a holiday, I think. And they were about to like hit the road to go to the park. And they're like, oh, no, there was some buildup on our meter. It's giving us a false reading. I'm like, you got to be kidding me.
Thanks for the heart attack.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, luckily I called everything off there to. That's a good point. One of the things was like, I think their manhole was never big enough. Every single park I try to do that in, I'd have to put in another manhole or some junk.
Like it's expensive. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it, yeah, sometimes you can have your on-site manager, like if you have an issue, just read the master meter that's, you know, the municipalities like every day. Like every day at the same time, go check the meter and like how many gallons are you using per day? But you know, you gotta have a manager that's on it, you know, to do that.
Right. Yeah, I see what you're saying. No, that's a good point. Yep.
Yeah. So what do you think, Dustin, has been like the toughest hurdle for you, you know, from going from that first park now to 9 parks all in the same state, which is awesome. What's been the hardest part?
I think it's probably a mix of just like time management for me anyway. I'm still working full time.
Wow.
My day job. It is a flexible job. I'll say that, you know, I can get up early and do some work and then take a phone call from a contractor, you know, middle of the day, if I need to, if I'm not in the middle of a meeting or what have you there, I'm not traveling. Sometimes there's some travel involved with that, but,
nice.
It's like time management. So I've been trying to get better. I guess one of the ways I've gotten better at that is just, you know, investing in software. I do everything through Rent Manager. That I was not a fan of trying to like get that when I was getting started, because I'm like, why do I need to buy this software? I only have one park or whatever. But I'm like, no, I'm gonna do it. If I'm gonna scale this kind of eventually here, it's gonna make sense at some point. So that's been helping.
Do you use it for the accounting side as well?
I do. Everything. I do. Yeah, but I was doing that myself for a while. Only recently I hired someone to kind of help me with that.
The bookkeeping
and some other functions in Rent Manager. Because I'm trying to switch everything over to there, so I don't have bunch of different systems. So now I'm on the phone system through them. You know, Metron obviously integrates with that. I'm still not on everything.
Or like the Rent Butter or Amrent for the background checks.
That was the only, now I feel like I might have to do that. I don't actually screen that many folks though. I don't know about you. I'm not, I guess when I infill, that's that's one factor. But if the parks, until I bought these most recent parks, I was rather like almost full occupancy wise. So I wasn't screening that many folks. There wasn't that much turnover. So I was just doing one off. You know, background checks on folks, but maybe that, which one do you use? Are you on the Rent Butter?
Rent Butter now.
Okay.
And it's been pretty good. Yeah. We've had good success with it, but we were on Amrent before then.
Oh, okay. Was Rent Butter, you got to pay like basically an integration fee and then they bill that right to the tenant there, the applicant maybe. I'm not sure how that works.
Man, it's been a while since I've looked at that, but I think it's I think it's like per park. Yeah, I don't know exactly. I could get back to you on that.
I'm pretty sure I pinged a couple emails to some folks on that. So anyway.
Yeah. So let's talk here. So you're up to what, about almost 300 lots? Mm-hmm. Are you managing it all yourself, just you and your wife?
Yeah. I will say my wife isn't probably super involved in day-to-day there. I've got she's kind of the household management, if you know what I mean? We got four kids, so.
Oh, nice. She's, I have four kids as well.
Yeah. I saw that. That's awesome. That online. Yeah. Yep. So that's, you know, as well as I do, that's a pretty hefty
full-time job with overtime.
Yeah. No doubt. They're upstairs probably wreaking havoc right now. So I have like park managers. I forgot what the question was, but I have park managers that help at the parks, kind of day-to-day stuff. But then I recently hired someone to kind of help. She's on Rent Manager. Getting trained on Rent Manager. She helps field, you know, text messages and voicemails and some of the accounting functions.
Nice.
Just to help. But honestly, I always have, it's hard not to have just Rent Manager open on the side on a second screen. Yeah, on a second screen just to, I just can't help myself. You know, you see your dashboard, you've got all your metrics and you've got your delinquency and you're like, okay, well, I'm about to send out 10 text messages to these guys here to see where it's the rent easy. Is at. Just makes it to do. Too easy. Yeah.
That's awesome. Tell us about your like most recent acquisitions and how you've been getting deals done with the higher interest rates and, you know, the current climate.
Yeah, the most recent deal was a package of two parks. It was two parks just in like the northeast Wisconsin area here. So not too far from Green Bay where I'm at. So these actually were the closest parks that I own. Everything else is like 2 or 3, 4 hours away. That was that bigger park. It was a 54 space park and a 42 space park. And yeah, just a broker that I've got a good relationship with brought that to me there. And it was very, you know, it was very reasonable in terms of, I guess it was maybe more aggressively priced because the rents were super low, but you know, it's still made sense. That was
it value add? Like how many were occupied? Was it public utilities?
Exactly. Yeah. I actually don't own anything that's not on public utilities. That's kind of one of my sticking points there. I've just tried to maintain that only Smart. Public utilities. I don't really want to even think about learning well and septic and what could come with those.
Yeah.
I know.
It gets probably ugly fast. I'll just tell you that. Because like we have a park that has 67 septic tanks and 67 leach fields. And every month we're like, you know, there's roots getting in the leach field and we're, you know, $3,000 to replace, you know, the lateral line. So it adds up quick. Uh-huh.
Yeah. I'd get pretty nervous about that myself here. Cause like you said, one thing goes wrong on that and all of a sudden you're in a pickle there. Yeah. These both were value add parks, mostly because the rents were like 220 lot rent, 245 in the other park. So it's like, they just never kept up with, in kind of a long time owner, never kept up with the standard rent raises. And so that was a clear, you know, indication. You don't even have to be an expert on like the area. You just said, you know, that 220, like nobody's at 220 anymore.
Yeah.
Same with infill. I think maybe 75 out of 90 out of the 96 occupied in that package there. So nice. Yeah, I'm a pretty big, you know, used home infill. Whenever I can manage it there, I just think they can be more affordable for the end, you know, as the end product there to sell off. So I just
Tell us about that. Tell us how you do that, because I'm a big fan of used homes as well.
Mm-hmm.
And with the pricing of new homes, that they it seemed like they went from like 30,000 to like 50,000 like real fast, like just from COVID. It was like, okay, the normal you can go, you know, get some homes from 30 to 35,000, even like there's like 28,000, and then all of a sudden after COVID it's like 50,000 is the cheapest they got.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's kind of frustrating actually, because I would love to hit, it's not the easy button, but like it'd be great to just have five new homes show up and
you can time it all up, line up the contractors, easy, 100%. Yeah.
I get them from wherever I can find them, really. So that's like Facebook Marketplace. I'm on there, you know, or I have, you know, some folks that are looking around for me. They're just like, you know, and you can find, $5,000 or $10,000, you know, 1990s, 16 by 80 or 14 by 70, any of the above, really. It'll just all of a sudden pop up because someone's bought some land with a home on it and now they need it gone because they want to build their own house. So that, I'm scoping that every day. I got in touch with a couple good movers, transporters.
Nice.
That if they're moving a house, you know, someone wants a new house on their land, they got to get the old one off. They just are looking for someone like myself who's got somewhere to put it. So that's been really good.
And you manage all that yourself in addition to like the property management day to day.
Yeah. Right. That's probably actually the most time intensive now that you make me think about it, because that can just be.
Oh, yeah. The follow-up, the contractors, the transporters alone. You know, if you find a good transporter, they are worth their weight in gold. It's just been really tough for us to find consistent ones, you know, that are just reliable.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. Do you still have your, at one point, didn't you say like you had a truck or like a...
We bought a toter truck and started a transport and installation business, got licensed and everything, had it for a really big project where we infilled like, I think it was 60 lots.
Oh man.
And then my driver just decided like, hey, I don't want to be on the road all the time. You know, he did like more than one project. I think he did like three or four projects, had it for about 2 years, but we actually just canceled the insurance and shut it down, because it's also very expensive if you want to go over state lines, you know, outside of your state. You have to get these IFTA stickers with like the Department of Transportation. And that's why like some transporters take a home to the state line and then they have another guy come and pick it up and like use it, you know, drive it the rest of the way in the other state, is because it's like so expensive to get those IFTA stickers to like cross state lines, and it makes it exponentially harder. So.
Now that makes sense actually, because I know some guys that I try to find some, you know, on neighboring states homes that come up and I can only go 30 miles into there or something like that.
Yeah.
Gets a little hairy. So that makes sense now that you're saying that, if it's wildly expensive. But yeah, luckily I just have some right now. I've got a couple good contacts, and I think they get homes too from like parks that closed down.
Mm-hmm.
They now just have kind of dibs on all of them, their inventory. So they're not all nice. That's the other tricky part, is like, as you know, like, well, who's gonna fix up this thing? Not everybody likes fixing up mobile homes. So my dad actually has volunteered. He's recently retired, very handy. He's like, hey, I'll go fix up some homes, you know, just put me up in a hotel or whatever. So that's been a you know.
Is he willing to travel to Indiana?
Well,
I got a couple down there, you know.
You never know. Put them up at they got a Ritz-Carlton at Indiana. Probably. No, I'm just joking. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome though. How has your strategy changed? Like your mobile home park investing strategy? Like, is there something that you were doing early on that now you don't do? I mean, you said like you stick with public utilities. Mm-hmm. You know, like your most recent acquisition, you bought a couple bigger parks, you know, compared to the smaller ones. What's changed and why?
I think the only thing I am now really focusing on, before I thought if you bought anything in Wisconsin, and there's a little backstory to that. When I took that boot camp, I come to find out that like Frank and Dave and all those kind of bigger guys in the market, they owned a ton in Wisconsin. So I'm like, damn, this is great. I mean, it's kind of like a blessing, because you're like, oh, wow, this must be a great market. And it's a curse because like they own a bunch of stuff in the state. So. But anyway, I was like, gosh, if they think this is a great state, I must, anything I buy here is going to just be like, you know, as good as it gets in terms of, you know, tenant base and able to sell homes and, you know, all the above. That's not the case. I do own like a couple parks that I was like, oh, I'm going to go chase these. And like, they are in tougher markets. Mm-hmm. It's just not as like, there's not as many jobs. So that is, you know, these couple parks I have in mind here, they just have more delinquency if I were to compare it to these other parks. And they have, I can't sell homes nearly as much. I have to sit on them or like heavily discount them, which is fine. They still sell everything. Everybody still pays eventually. It's just like, clearly markets matter. And
is
you don't
it,
even
is yeah. it smaller markets or is it like a part of town that's a bad part of town or what is it?
No. It's just smaller towns. It's just like, you know, 1,000 people towns. And then there's the next closest city mm-hmm. is only 20,000 people, like where the, you know, where like a Walmart is. So it gets really tricky.
Those are the ones where you can get the best deals, right? You're like, oh, this is a 12 cap. This is going to be, how can this not be a home run deal? But, you know, we own a park like right in urban Kenosha mm-hmm. and, mm-hmm. you know, it's smaller homes, but like the demand is crazy. Like the waiting list is like 50 people long. It stays full. If we are going to have a vacancy, there's like no turnover time because it's like, okay, you're moving out. This right. person's like wants to buy the home from you. Here's three people that want to buy your home from you.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
we give that to our tenant and then coordinate, kind of broker the sale. So yeah, markets are super important, but that's not to discount, you know, the mid-sized markets, because I think they need the affordable housing. And we've had some, like we own a park in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. It's not in an MSA. If you mm-hmm. Google it and look at like all the stats, you'd be like, this is a very rural area, but it's like one of our best parks, just prints.
Wow.
Like it's just consistency, reliability, high demand. So I think it's just finding those little pockets, you know, that get the good deals, but you're also able to have high demand, right?
Yeah, that's the trick, I think. I think most of my stuff isn't technically in an MSA, but it's right outside of it. And it's a big enough mm-hmm. MSA that's like, it extends growing. Beyond what the maps maybe say it is. Sure. I don't even know who defines those. It, you know, sometimes I look at it, I'm like, who came up with these? It's all by the county.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure where that comes from at the end of the day. So like being right on the outskirt is like, I think actually perfect. You can find mm-hmm. good, you know, better deals that doesn't meet the MSA, but it technically, you talk to a couple people and they're like, oh yeah, I commute to Minneapolis is the one I'm thinking about. You've got a pretty good extension of like Minneapolis, for example, that extends into Western Wisconsin. So that's where some of mine sit. And those are great. I mean, I can sell homes. I can, you know, lot rents are really competitive. So, and then,
Is there anything else like outside of market that you would say you've like learned from and like you've changed your buying criteria on future acquisitions from that awareness now?
Other than the market, I'd be really wary of like, I guess I don't know if I would have bought these earlier on, but like really bad infrastructure. That just would scare me.
Water sewer yeah. lines that are really old and like,
that's
like
right.
that kind of stuff, or like just old pedestals.
Probably like really, really capital intensive stuff that I couldn't negotiate. Fun story is this two part deal that I purchased that I'm talking about was originally a three park deal. The third park, however, was like riddled with Orangeburg, and I just couldn't stomach even thinking about what it would take to do it. And a good friend of mine ended up actually making sense of like the numbers and negotiating some price reduction and stuff at closing. And he was able to kind of like make it work, which was great. But I was like, that just ain't for me. I just, that, you know, that gets me a little out of my comfort zone. So I pay a lot of attention to like, and spend a lot of time and money on sewer inspections.
Yeah,
making sure there's no water leaks going into it there with old water lines and stuff like that. I try to like, maybe I spend more time on that than I originally did, because I think those can just eat your lunch.
100%. And there's deals out there that look like good deals on paper and on the spreadsheets. But then when you start looking through the due diligence, I've had three deals under contract in the last year, and I look at them and I'm like, okay, there's obviously a large water leak here.
Yep.
So I'm talking to the broker. The broker's kind of telling me what I want to hear. And then I talk to the seller. Seller's kind of telling me what I want to hear. I talk to the contractor. The contractor's like, oh yeah, I told the seller, you know, 4 months ago, he needs to replace all the water lines in here. He has like 6 leaks. And then I take that back. I'm like, bro, I'm like, hey guys, you listed this thing 3 months ago, like right after you got that information. Like, what's going on here? And then they send over the cancellation of contract. So it's like, there's people out there trying to get you to make a bad move. And if you're not careful, you know, that's a 6-figure mistake if you don't identify that beforehand.
Yeah, it definitely can be. And this was like, you know, this one in particular that I'm talking about there, I don't know what the bid actually came back at, but I think it was in the hundreds of thousands to remedy this orange berg. If you're going to do it in one, you know, one move or whatever, replumb the whole park there. It's like, who can?
Yeah. If you don't know about
that.
The one park in Kenosha that's in like very urban Kenosha had like a run of orange berg in it. And like, basically when we found that out, we're like, oh, we should probably kill the deal, but let's just get a quote to see like, hey, what's going on here and how much it would cost. And we got a quote, and even it was just like a run of, I think, 20 homes, and it was going to be like 150,000. So luckily we were able to get a repair credit for that.
But
you know, if you don't know beforehand and you buy that, and then that's, your investors are going to be pretty upset. Well, you don't have investors, but you know, your cash flow is going to be gone.
Exactly. Are you going to, did your guys already do that repair? Are you going to wait till it makes more
sense?
We
haven't. There's no, that's the thing, is it's Orangeburg, and there was like some, not puddles, what are they called? Some like bellies in the line.
Yeah, yeah.
But it wasn't like you know, causing any issues right now. And it's like the middle of winter. So if we do it now, because we just bought it a few months ago. So it's like, we do it now, is going to be more expensive with the ground frozen and everything. So we're going to wait and do it like spring, summer. But we got the contractors lined up. Went into the city and looked at the permits that have been pulled like the last year and found some contractors through those permits of who's done like major infrastructure work, like utility and sewer line infrastructure work. And that's where we found this contractor. So that.
Oh, nice. Nice. Yeah. I guess if it's not, so is that your mentality there? You're not going to wait till it fails to do something about it. You're going to just like bite the bullet.
We did it. We got the price reduction. We got the repair credit. So like, we're just going to get it done, because it's only a matter of time. It's literally the Orangeburg is like paper mache. Like, have you ever seen it? Like, I've touched it and picked it up, and it just like disintegrated in my hands. And I was like, how has this been in the ground? Like, it doesn't make any sense.
I've got the sewer camera video that I took of the one I'm describing there. We could pull it up for the viewers if they wanted to see what it looks like in real time. It's pretty awful.
That'd be cool if you can share your screen. I don't know if you can.
I'd have to search. I didn't prep. But
Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Then,
next time.
Yeah.
Put it in the notes or something. I'll like link it to like Dropbox or something.
That'd be fun. That'd be fun if you want to go down a dirty Orangeburg sewer line. You know, who doesn't want to do that? Who doesn't want to see what that looks like?
Yeah.
So if you were going to passively invest in a mobile home park deal with like another operator, what would be like the most important things you would like look for before, you know, wiring the money?
Well, I preface this, I never have done any sort of like LP stuff, but if I were, I mean, I think I'd ask like the classic, you know, have you done this in the past? How many times? Like, what's your prior results? All that normal stuff. But for me, I'm just like, I just would want to like try to talk to whoever the, you know, GP is there face to face, and just try to get a feel for like kind of person they are. I don't know. Is this guy going to like screw me over? Is he going to be someone, is he someone I could actually see myself like sitting down and having lunch with or something like that? I'm not saying you got to be friends with the guy, but I feel like you can just tell a lot from that. I have a hard time trusting folks who just, you know, big talk, they talk nonstop, and they just, you know, they're in the pitch mode and salesman type scenario there, versus like, well, here's what we're offering, you know, if you're interested, you can invest type of thing. I think that's where I would, it's more of like a gut. It's more of a gut feeling. You don't know, you know, you can see their prior results, but.
Yeah. It's crazy to me how many, like, I would say like 90 to 95% of the investors that have invested in our deals, I haven't ever seen. They're just like, wire the money and take it, which is like terrifying. Cause like,
sure.
Like what you're saying, I would do the same thing. I want to talk through the deal. I want to talk through like the value add and kind of the plan and the time frame. And, you know, most people are, you know, I've had people fly to Florida to meet with me before they invest with me. And like, we sat down and had coffee, but most people, you know, they don't do that, which is crazy. But I agree. Well, I think that's a good way to kind of get to know somebody.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's for you though. I mean, that kind of speaks to you, almost like your reputation and what you're doing on here. Cause I, to be honest, that does go a long way in my head. I don't know. I just get the, when I see you, like, you know, listen to you on interviews and see you on Instagram posting stuff of your family, I'm like, oh, this guy's got values. You know, he's not just out here hustling people and stuff like that, or he's an incredible actor. If he's doing all this for show, and he's running off with his four kids and his wife to some, you know, after he takes my money. I don't think that's the case. So, like, that's what I would look for. I'm just not. I would have such a hard time finding someone, you know, searching them out and being like, oh, this guy buys mobile home parks. Some like no name, or, you know, I just see the company name, not the actual operator.
The person.
Yeah. That's what I would say.
Yeah. I appreciate that, Dustin. I mean, I think there is something to be said from that, you know, like just people with values and just very transparent, you know, like you are, you know, just very, hey, this is what I've learned. This is, I'm trying to help other people. And you know, you're able to still build that passive income and build the dream, right? Of, you know, being able to work from anywhere, technically.
That's the dream. Yeah. I'm hoping to do that one time. Like, I mean, I don't know if I'll ever get to the, you know, where you kind of went down the path of. I was going to ask you that, like, in hindsight, you know, you've obviously done the self, you've owned them yourself and built the portfolio yourself. You went on to take on investors, buy bigger deals, expand. Is there ever, like, in your head, would you ever go back to be like, oh, would I ever, you know, I think I saw you said you own like 3,000 lots or something like this. Would you ever consider, like, should I have owned like 500 and had like some just myself? Are you?
I still think, no, that's a great question. That's probably the best question I've been asked on this podcast. I think there's been levels to this. And there's been like three times where we've like hit a ceiling and it was like the wheels are falling off because it's growing problems, right? Growing pains. So we would grow into this and we didn't have the team to support it. And we would have like this like breakdown of like one time our head bookkeeper, like during COVID, just like stopped paying bills, like just stopped going to the PO box and stopped paying bills. So then we got like these notices. I was notified like that, like we got these notices that like the utilities were going to get shut off and all of this. And I'm like, how is this even happening? Like, this is blocking and tackling, right? This is the easy part. And like, I had to go to the PO box and take out all this mail. And then I had to go bring a card to the desk and get a big container, like a big, what do they call them? Like the big, you know, huge container full of mail. So then I had to open all the mail myself. And then I had to, this was like during COVID. And then I had to like start paying bills and, you know, checking usage rates and all of that. So it's just like, you know, but she got overwhelmed and she didn't say anything. She didn't want to like hurt my feelings and tell me that, hey, I'm drowning here. I can't keep up with the amount of mail we're getting. And so we just kind of like, you know, there's been like three times that come to mind where like we've hit that. And then, you know, we'll hire ahead a little bit, what we think is ahead, and kind of catch up. But no, I do think about that. And I think taking on investors has been really rewarding because most of my investors are like friends and family and like, or friends and family, like referrals of friends and family. So it's like been really rewarding when like we hit a deal that's like just rocket, you know, to the moon status. Mm-hmm. And then everybody wins and like everybody's really happy. And it's been, you know, the asset class, you know, has done really well. Like it's not rocket science. And when you do the blocking and tackling, it can be very successful. So I think it's been a good choice. But growing just to grow. I don't recommend it.
Yeah. I kind of waver on the matter myself. I just, my whole goal was just to kind of support, you know, my family and eventually step back from my full-time job. I don't foresee that anytime soon. I like my full-time job, but I think that's the natural progression for most folks is like, if they get enough where they are getting too much to handle on their own, they need to kind of scale up, change the systems. And I don't know. I'm stuck in that analysis of like, is that where I want to take things next, or am I content? I think there's a peacefulness in that as well. Just like keeping what I have, optimizing it, you know, grow over a little bit over time. So
100%. No, I think there's some, you know, there's something to be said about like keeping your inner peace and not being like, you know, we have 50 parks, but we're like, you know, pulling my hair out all the time.
Drowning.
Like, I'd rather have, you know, 30 parks or 25 or whatever that number is, but be sane. And I think that's what we're starting to do is like prune off some of the, some of the parks that maybe are in the not so great markets or have a little bit higher delinquency and we have to chase them a little bit more, just prune off some of those. And then just really take our time on new acquisitions to try to buy in, you know, better markets. And to me, when I say better markets, I really like to see population growth and I like to see median home prices like really high. Like $300,000 median home prices and, you know, lot rents are like 250. Like, you know, that is an area that you're gonna have a long runway, in my opinion.
Yeah. You just use best places for that. Generally,
I actually have been using Zillow. So I'll just Google and instead of using like, Kenosha median home price, I'll go zip code. So I'll be like, okay, this zip code inside of there, I'll just Google whatever the zip code is. And then I'll type in median home price Zillow. And then it'll usually pop up right at the top, you know, what the median home price is in that Zillow, in that zip code. And that's like a more, more specific area, more accurate number that's, you know, constantly updated. So
I like that. That's good. I never even thought about that. Yeah. I definitely have Zillow, but I didn't zoom into like a zip code specific.
Cause another thing that I've found a lot of help in, and I actually found this at a self-storage mastermind. Ooh. But if you go to City Data, the website, city-data.com.
Okay.
It's another like census kind of website.
Yeah.
And they have like a ton of information on like zip codes and areas, but in the zip code, do Command F and type in poverty and it'll bring you right to the poverty rate of an area. And if the poverty rate is like over 15%, like that's something we stay away from because that alone, like there's some markets, like I see deals in like Mississippi and Alabama all the time that look like really good deals. And then I'll look at the poverty rate and it's like 33%. And I'm like, oh my goodness, like that is the delinquency problems and everything. Like I would not want to mess with that.
I'm super curious. The one, you know, the park I mentioned that's really hard to sell homes. I'm dying to go look what that rate is at. I would suspect it's higher. I suspect it's all correlated, like you said.
Totally. Yeah. We found this because we bought some duds, right? We bought a park in Keokuk, Iowa. Mm. And it was the same thing. It was so tough to sell homes. And if we did sell like an RTO type of home, the most down payment we could get was $1,000. And that was like pulling teeth.
Yeah.
Where like other markets, like we have one in Columbia, Tennessee, where like the down payment on the RTOs, the minimum is $5,000. And we're getting that like all day. And it's a much better market, much more demand. And so we're just trying to like in our test ads and everything, just avoid the Keokuk markets and buy more in these better markets, even if we have to pay up a little bit more per lot. You know, I think long term with the rent growth possibilities, we'll be better off.
Yeah. Definitely. How are you guys judging like rent growth? I mean, are you just kind of seeing what other parks are doing? Are you basing it on like the
equivalent? I think the biggest one is what the other comps are doing.
Yeah.
You know, and like obviously we're not the Yes Communities or these UMHs that have like brand new swimming pools and playgrounds and stuff. But I think we could be, you know, 80% of what they're charging for lot rent, and they're raising it every single year. In addition to that, we look a lot at median home price, and like if we times it by like 0.002, like 2% of median home price, that's been like a, you know, not a perfect depiction of what lot rent should be, but it's like something to kind of look at is 0.002 of median home price.
0.002.
And then 40% of the 3-bedroom apartment rents is like another just gauge that we'll look at. And then maybe we'll take the average between the 40% of apartment rents and the 0.002 of the median home price, just to kind of see how those level up in addition to like the local comps. Cause you know, some mom and pop markets, like all the parks are owned by like one family and they've just never raised rents, but it, you know, the median home price is 350. And it's like, there's a missed correlation here.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I do the same. I'm kind of curious. That's an interesting calculation there, what you just described there, but I definitely do the, take a look at some of the bigger, like the bigger operators in Wisconsin. Anyway, there was, I think RHP I think RHB, they bought like 40 or 50 communities, and they're just kind of, so they're by far the largest owner in the state now. And you can call any of their communities and kind of see what they're yeah. doing. They're not hitting all their existing tenant base with it, but you can ask, hey, you know,
new move-ins,
what are you guys charging? And it's like more than I ever would have thought, to be honest. Yeah. So like, but they also probably have a team of guys doing that homework and then going through stuff. So
yeah, I'm just following rent comps. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm, for sure. As long as I'm chasing them, yeah, I feel
you're
pretty
in a
good.
Great spot.
I feel pretty good. And Andrew Keel's in Southeast Wisconsin now. So I just would call, I'll call his park up too, see what's going on.
Dude, you know what's great in the state of Wisconsin is the Manufactured Housing Association. Do
they're
you
the best.
Work with them at all? Every time we call them, we were in due diligence. This is our first deal in Wisconsin. We called them and they were so helpful. Like, we weren't even members yet. You know, we are now that we own, but like, they were just so helpful, like went out of their way to like hook us up with like local attorneys that know MH and everything. Like, it was amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's probably at least monthly. I ping them for something.
The vendor list they gave us. Yeah. I mean, for like you're saying, transporters, installers, like other vendors. So they're useful.
You got to come to the meeting. I think there's like at least one annual, well, it'd be the one annual meeting, but then there's random other meetings. So you just got to come up to Wisconsin.
If I do, you gotta promise to bring me some of those cheese curds.
Oh,
what's
yeah.
that place
yeah.
up there, the with the good cheese curds that they have at like the state fair?
Well, there's probably a dozen different like premium brands there where there's extra squeaky. If you don't know what a good cheese curd is, if it squeaks, that's your measure of whether or not it's fresh and good. So honestly, go to like any of like the, you guys got farmers markets?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I assume you do, but like, yeah, that's the best place to get, in my opinion, because there's like five different options. Usually it's local farms or whatever that come with their own stuff or whatever. And you're just like,
yeah,
oh my God, it's about as good as you get.
No preservatives. yeah. Just the real pure stuff. That's so awesome.
Yeah.
Dustin, what do you think the perfect mobile home park looks like?
Just for me, it's definitely on public utilities for all the reasons I already mentioned there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think we already hit on it, but I'm a huge fan of everything just outside of the, even outside MSA. Of a normal MSA. Yeah.
If it's outside
on the outskirts. Yeah. Right on the outskirts, 30, 40 minutes from the city center.
Mm.
Any smaller neighborhood, because that's where everybody lives. Everybody like, well, for me anyway, like a lot of my tenant base, that's where like they want to live. They could have the option to move closer, but it costs too much. So they live right on the outskirts.
Yeah.
Still easy to commute. Still has all the amenities. You can still get towns that have, you know, Walmarts, even if they're not right in the MSA there. I mean, I actually use that as a pretty good measure as well. Is it like 20 minutes from a super Walmart? If it is, again, those guys got teams. Those guys got teams sitting in
the boot camp. Frank talks about that. Yeah. Where's the nearest Sonic? Where's the nearest Walmart? There's something to be said about that.
Yeah. You know, Walmart's got a whole, you know, floor dedicated to like, is this a good market before we spend all this money here? So like, you got to believe if you're 20 minutes away from that, they did the research. There's demand, there's people, there's some growth. So that's what I'm scouting for, is just stuff not in the big cities necessarily. I think you actually get, I'd be interested if you get like a hard time dealing with any like the city in Kenosha. Kenosha's pretty big, but then again, it is outside of like really big stuff, Milwaukee and in Chicago and whatnot. So that's probably okay. But like, I just shy away from, I love like cities with 5,000 people or 10,000 people or whatever there versus like 50 plus.
Yeah.
Anyway,
we have a park in Roseville, Michigan, which is like very close to Detroit, and it's very, very urban, very dense. And the city is like really tough. Like with we need a permit for everything. So, you know, renovating a mobile home, you need to replace the door, you need a permit. You're going to change the window, you need a separate permit from the door, like permit. So it's just like over engineering and regulation. And like, it gets hard to get anything done because you're pulling permits to, you know, change the skirting. And it's just, it's like too far. So you know, there is a benefit to kind of being in the outskirts, being in the county, right? Where it's just a little more freedom for sure.
I'd say, that's my perfect, that's the perfect park there. Maybe like I also like the, I mean, I don't have experience with something really big, but 30 pads, I don't know, 30 pads seems you can still afford like an on-site manager to kind of keep an eye on things. They're maybe not doing that all that much beyond just kind of like going to run errands for you there, keeping an eye on things. Still allows you to pay for snow plowing and all the normal operating expenses. And you still make a good, you know, it's still a healthy kind of property there once you kind of get the rents to where they need to be and do all the sub-metering and infill and stuff like that. So that's where I've kind of lived. That's like my little bubble there.
That's your comfort zone.
Everybody's coming for them now. Honestly, like,
yeah,
I feel like even
more competitive for those smaller ones. Yeah. Under 50 lots used to be like, you know, where there's huge opportunity. I still think there's huge opportunity under 50 lots. But like, you know, people are catching on, you know, for sure.
Yeah.
So
100%.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would say like direct bill, you know, over 100 lots. But I like that you're just like, all right, I'll take my bite-sized little 30-lot park that is quiet and, you know.
They kill it. I mean, I don't know what the scale. Maybe that's different. That scale of killing it is different for everybody. But like, you do a little bit of value add. And it's not even that much. You infill a few homes. You raise the rent a little bit. You sub-meter. And it's like, whoa, this thing was a dog. And now it's.
Yeah.
Looks, I mean, it's like
so much better. And
This thing's actually kicking off some cash flow. Everybody's happy because I'm able to reinvest some in there.
Yeah.
So that's cool. I think that's the secret sauce for me. Yeah.
Awesome, Dustin. Yeah. What's the future look like for you and your company? Like, you know, you're still looking to buy more? You're looking to take on money from investors? Kind of what does that look like?
Yeah, I think I'm going to focus this, I think focusing this year on like optimizing what I've got would actually be the best use of my time. And that's kind of where I always go back to is like, what's the best use of my time? I feel like it's, that's the limitation for me anyway, is just like, I got so many hours to kind of get some stuff done. And as soon as I chase the next deal, all that stuff kind of gets put on hold. I mean, you know that. So I think this year is I've got a bunch of homes I want to infill. To one of those new parks that has like 15 or 16 empty pads. So like, I've already got like five of them on standby. They're just kind of sitting there now waiting to get set up in the spring. I feel like if I could, again, push stuff like that, I think I'm going to get kind of the biggest bang for my time essentially there. So that, and in the future, I don't know, it's more of like, I think you got to reevaluate, you know, I think at the point where it's like you, what you said, like one of those inflection points where it's like, I think I need to maybe hire out more, figure out a different way of doing things if I want to keep going beyond. Maybe I could do one or two more parks in the current kind of systems I got. But that's where I think I'd hesitate a little bit unless I figured some stuff out. So I'm trying to figure that out as I go there. I don't think I have any dream of like, taking on investors right now anyway, but that's just my latest
thought. Where you're at with things.
I'll change it tomorrow. I'll rethink it when I'm like walking the dog tonight, like, you know what, what,
you,
I just,
know what,
that's silly, yeah.
No, I totally I totally relate. And you know, I grew up with like the buy and hold mindset, like I'm gonna buy, I'm gonna refi, I'm gonna hold these things forever, I'm never gonna sell. And I think when interest rates are really low, you know, that makes a lot of sense. But, you know, as interest rates have gone up, you know, it's, I think it makes more sense to kind of prune off, sell a couple every year, buy a couple new ones every year to kind of offset the taxes and, you know, just kind of keep moving, but kind of keep that threshold of having enough scale where you can have help, right?
Yeah.
But not like too much help where like you're trying to like, you know, hire ahead, because, you know, that's what has been tough for us. It's like, I would hire ahead and then like all my cash flow was going to payroll. And it was like, wait a minute, like I need to have a life here. Like, I need to take my wife on vacation or something. She's getting mad at me. I gotta have more balance. You know,
we just talked about vacation. It comes up often in the house here. So that's a big factor.
You gotta enjoy life for sure. Dustin, last question. What is the biggest threat in your eyes to mobile home park investing?
I guess maybe if people like it would be self-inflicted, I think, by like ourselves as operators. If we just go there and just are like off the rails with rent raises and stuff like that, we're just kind of ruins the reputation there. It's always been, you know, it's supposed to, I guess, the way it was taught to me and the way I still operate, it should be like the most affordable, unsubsidized version of housing. And it should be, and it can be. And I think it should continue to be so, because that's why it's so good. Everyone, yeah. You know, who's just, you know, needs that affordable place to live, and you give them all the value of having a yard and a 3-bedroom, 2-bath home and parking spot and maybe a garage or whatever right in front of the house. That's like a sweet deal. Like if we ruin that by just jacking up rents and just getting carried away with it and stuff like that, and try to compete with whatever you want to say, the other markets that are out there, and apartments and condos and stuff like that. That's, I feel like we would just like probably shoot ourselves in the foot, or, you know? So I think as long as we're just like reasonable with just like staying the most affordable product in town, I feel like that's the best thing. I feel like it's never going away. Yeah. It should just be here, you know, forever at that point there. So yeah.
If people are reasonable with it, it should fend off the extra regulation and stuff, because it is housing, right? It's not a triple net lease on a Starbucks, right? This is, there is people that live in these things full time. So I agree with you, man. Good, good feedback there. How could listeners get a hold of you or find out about you and your business, Dustin, if they'd like to do so?
I'm on all the social media platforms there, LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook. What else? I'm not on there all that much, but like you can definitely get a hold of me. And then my email is like, it's dustin@blazemhc.com. So just send me an email. That's cool.
Cool. I'll put it in the show notes. And yeah, Dustin, thanks so much for coming on and sharing your story with us.
Thanks, Andrew. I appreciate it.
Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Have a good day.
Would you like to see Mobile Home Park value add projects in progress? If so, follow us on Instagram @PassiveMHPInvesting for photos and awesome videos from our recent mobile home park acquisitions. Once again, that's @PassiveMHPInvesting on Instagram. See you there.